You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Here's a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Across the U.S., roughly one out of every three babies are born via C-section. That's more than 1 million babies each year. This procedure, of course, can be life-saving, but researchers estimate that nearly half of the C-sections performed in the U.S. aren't needed, which pose added risks to mother and child. A new investigation from Consumer Reports uncovers another finding about C-sections that may surprise you. A woman's risk of having a C-section can be more than 9 times higher depending on the hospital she chooses. The investigation looks at data for first-time low-risk mothers across the U.S. In Illinois, the chance of a C-section for these women is just below the national average. It's about 1 in 4, but again, that risk varies dramatically depending on the hospital. I'm joined now by the journalist behind that new report, Tara Haley. She's a freelance health reporter based in Peoria. Also joining us on the line from Chicago, Dr. Maura Quinlan is the Illinois chair of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Tara, Dr. Quinlan, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tara, the data you looked at was for first-time low-risk mothers, and you found up to a 9-fold difference, as I was just explaining. Even different hospitals in the same neighborhood could have vastly different rates. What do you think is behind this?
There's a couple of different things going on. The rate that we're looking at is for first-time moms who are having single children, so not multiples. And the child's head is in the head down position, and they're at full term. They're at least 38 weeks along. And most of the women in those circumstances should have a very low rate of C-sections. It won't be zero because emergencies happen, and there are women who would have other conditions such as gestational diabetes or preeclampsia. But for the most part, that there should be a very low rate among that population. But what happens is in the hospital, a couple of different things can really change that. And the biggest thing is honestly the culture. It really has to do with what the mechanisms are in that hospital to deal with high volume patients and what happens when they get crowded and how the doctors assess situations. Two of the biggest contributors to the C-section rates are not actually what a lot of people think they are, which, a lot of people think it's, oh, mothers are unhealthy and, that's increasing it. And that's not the big culprit. The big culprits are heart rate monitors for babies because they're very easily misinterpreted and they have a very low accuracy rate. And the second thing is perceptions of how quickly labor is progressing. So there's a term called labor dystocia, which means stalled labor. And if a woman truly is stalled in her labor, she truly may need an emergency C-section. But that's a subjective measure. And women's, the labor curves that we used to use long ago don't necessarily apply to the same populations today. Women labor longer today than they used to. So when you put all those factors together, that's why you have such dramatic rates. It's going to depend on what's happening in that hospital. A lot of hospitals that use midwives have lower rates, and hospitals where the doctors share their rates will have lower rates because, hey, doctors are competitive. They don't want to be the one with the highest rate. But none of that is to say that there aren't reasonable variations. Here in Peoria, where I am, two of the biggest hospitals are OSF St. Francis and Unity Point Methodist. OSF has a 28.3%. Unity Point has a 21.2%. But OSF, which is where I delivered my child, they have one of the largest ICUs in the state, and they are explicitly for high-risk pregnancies, which I was. So I'm still going to choose to deliver there because they cater to the kind of needs that I had, even though they had a higher rate, which makes sense when you consider some of the population. Whether it should be that high at 28% is, it really, that's up for debate.
Yeah, Tara, while we're talking about this, which hospitals had some of the lowest rates?
The three hospitals that had the lowest rates were Little Company of Mary Hospital and Health Care Centers in Evergreen with 10%, Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana, 11%, and Vista Medical Center East, Waukegan, at 11%. I should caution, those are really low rates, and we don't have a solid number on what's like the ideal C-section rate. That's almost an impossible number to pin down, and it's going to vary geographically by population and other things. But these rates are lower than what we would probably expect a national healthy rate to be when you don't see poor outcomes from infants. You have to track the infants at the same time you're tracking the moms to make sure that you're not sacrificing one problem for another.
Right. And before we get into all of that, Dr. Quinlan, I wondered if you could weigh in on what Tara was talking about. I know you've actually just stepped away from teaching residents to have this conversation with us. And I wonder what happens behind teaching, what goes into hospital philosophies about what Tara was talking about, especially when they can be kind of subjective calls based on heart rate monitors or other things that doctors and nurses are monitoring?
Sure. I think you brought up a good point that a big part, I think, of the indication for C-sections is this sort of failure to progress diagnosis, that the labor is sort of taking too long. And when I started practicing 25 years ago, there was this rough estimation that a mom should dilate, you know, a centimeter every 1 to 2 hours, depending on how many children she'd had. Pushing should last no longer than 2 to 3 hours. There was very a little bit random numbers that were associated with effective labors. And we all knew that someone we'd say, oh, you know, the labor's not progressing, but we had another C-section, so we'll have her wait, we'll do her second. Then we'd go back and check the patient, and she wouldn't have progressed over several hours. But then while we were waiting, delayed for some other reason, she had progressed. Or someone who really insisted on wanting to continue to push longer, change positions, et cetera, would deliver successfully vaginally. So I think that's what the part of the push for ACOG has been, to really relax those numbers, that everybody's labor is different, and some people take longer. But if the baby looks reassuring on the monitor, if the mom is comfortable, you know, she's doing okay, we really try to wait till it's been many hours without any dilation before we throw in the towel. Having said that, there are many patients, like oftentimes here at Northwestern where we're really busy, patients will say, please, I'm done. Can I just have a C-section? And our job is to be sort of the cheerleader for vaginal deliveries. No, you're okay. Let's give it time. And I feel like I say a million times a day, it's worth this baby will be worth the wait. You can do it. Or, you know, let's give it till whatever time, till 2 p.m. or give it a set time so that she knows we're not going to wait forever, but we could be more patient. So ACOG has had some guidelines to really relax that it's okay if things aren't progressing as fast as it might, that if the whole rest of the labor is reassuring, that we can be patient. The other thing that's dependent on the institution is vacuum or forceps. So many women, they're exhausted for a variety of reasons. It's taking longer to push, and the baby might be making some progress, but not delivering as fast as you might think. And one of the great ways to allow a vaginal delivery is to either do forceps or vacuum, which is a way that we sort of help guide the baby out as she's pushing. Thankfully, here at Northwestern, we do lots of forceps and vaginal vacuum deliveries to help women deliver vaginally. But some institutions aren't used to doing that. The folks aren't comfortable doing that. And so if that woman's been pushing a long time and she hasn't delivered, the choice would be C-section. So we could do better teaching, you know, making sure everyone sort of feels comfortable enough to be able to do a delivery that way.
Right. So you also, as you mentioned, you teach at the Feinberg School of Medicine, practicing at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. So, for example, at a huge hospital like Northwestern, I also always wonder if there's a tendency, and I think people who are, you know, I know in the birthing community, there's a lot of, I guess, emotion around natural delivery versus, you know, there's a lot of different aspects of like home birthing and all of these other things. And I think there might be a thought that hospitals push for C-sections and do it early just because they're worried about the health of the baby and the mother and for malpractice or other reasons. Do you think that's a pressure that exists at hospitals?
I do. I definitely think so. Although that wouldn't really explain why it's different hospital to hospital, but truly, and that's unfortunately the way of our system, that obstetricians very rarely get sued for doing a C-section, but you get sued for not. So for some providers, I mean, unfortunately, most obstetricians will have experience being sued over the course of their career, which is unfortunate and for another discussion, but that can drive providers to say, you know what, I can't wait. You know, I think this is going to end up in a C-section, or just to make that decision call perhaps a little bit sooner. And I think that's worth women could see if to find out the C-section rate of their provider, how much experience that person has, if they trained at a high volume place, which actually is really good because then they've seen a lot and are comfortable with a variety of things that can happen in labor. But I do think that malpractice, unfortunately, can be a factor for some obstetricians as they care for a woman in labor.
So, Tara, what are some things, based on your reporting, what are some things that you advise that women can do to avoid an unnecessary C-section? It sounds like there's a lot of education that also that families need to have before they need to be educated with before they go into the hospital.
We have a section on the Consumer Reports article that addresses exactly that, how to reduce your risk. We're careful not to say how to absolutely avoid it, because you can't ever avoid you can't guarantee that you're going to avoid a C-section. Emergencies happen, but you can reduce the likelihood that you'll end up with an unnecessary one. And that's with the caveat that determining what's quote unquote unnecessary is very, very difficult. There's no special formula for that. One is to find out where you're going to deliver, because the hospital's culture makes they've actually found in research that the same providers who would deliver at different hospitals have different rates at different hospitals. So the same provider will have a higher rate at the hospital with a higher rate, but a lower rate at the hospital with a lower rate. And that's not necessarily on the doctor. It often has to do with how the workflow goes. If the labor floor is set up in such a way that the hospital is not efficiently dealing with, say, a sudden influx of women in labor and they literally need beds, that may speed things up because they don't have, quality control indicators in place to address that issue. So looking at the hospitals is one way, looking at your provider and talking with your provider and making sure that your provider understands what your values are, that you know how they operate and what their thresholds are for risk. Consider using a midwife if you do have a low-risk pregnancy. Midwives are associated with lower C-section rates and tend to give more personalized attention. It's a different type of attention. You want to look for certified nurse midwives who have the full certification. Don't come in too early when you're in labor. You may be sent back home if you do come in too early. And just like the doctor was saying, don't rush to push that labor. Even when it's hard and you're in the midst of it and you're pushing, and I've had two kids, I know what that's like. Really realizing that the risks of C-sections aren't so much the immediate risks. It's not that you will have a longer recovery time and you may have more pain, but the real risks of a C-section are downstream issues with your second child or your third child, because then you're much more likely to have C-sections with those. And each additional C-section is going to increase various complication risks.
Yeah, I wonder, Dr. Quinlan, can you weigh in on what kind of complications women need to be concerned about?
Truthfully, the surgical risks of a very first C-section are, it is certainly major surgery with anesthesia and blood loss and that sort of thing. But the biggest risk for the first C-section is the second C-section. So, and that's why the ACOG, a lot of our documents say avoiding the first. If a woman has a vaginal delivery first time, the chance of her having a vaginal second time is great. She will push a shorter time. It will be much easier the second labor. The main risk of C-section is in the next pregnancy. So it's really acceptable and encouraged for women who've had one C-section to try for a vaginal delivery the second time, depending on the circumstances. But she has a small risk of that scar rupturing, of opening when she's in labor the next time. If she has a second C-section, the risk of that surgery is greater. She has scar tissue. The placenta can implant on the scar in the uterus that can cause significant problems. And it just gets worse each C-section. So if someone's hoping for four kids and has four C-sections, that can get really risky by that third and fourth, even the second.
You really just want to try to do a C-section once, it sounds like, is your kind of, from
correct.
A medical standpoint, that's kind of the goal.
The risk goes up at three, but the risk goes so down so much when someone's had a successful vaginal delivery that, like, for example, if we have to do forceps, if someone's exhausted from pushing or the baby's heartbeat is concerning, but the head is right there and we just need to guide the head out with forceps, that risk to the baby is very low and her next baby will be so much easier because she's already delivered vaginally.
Dr. Quinlan, we just have about a minute left. I wonder what tips you have for families who are probably thinking about this right now. What advice do you have for them to prepare?
I think what was said already, to understand this is going to take a long time, that labor can take a while, and everybody has a friend who, like, labored for 6 hours and pushed for 30 minutes, and that's freaky. I would say that's like the woman who wears
and
her...
And then everyone has the friend who labored for 26 hours as well.
Right. So, and there's someone in between. So, like, big picture. How are you? How is the baby? If everybody's fine, let's be patient. And I agree. I tell my patients always to stay home as long as you can. You're much more likely to have a vaginal delivery if you come in at 5 centimeters, the head is really well engaged. If you want an epidural, you can do that then, get comfortable, you know, have some rest before the time of pushing. But certainly coming in later in labor is helpful. And I think for couples to try to be patient themselves, it's so tempting to say, can I just be done? I just want a C-section. And for an obstetrician, you know, might say, okay, let's just move to that. But I think we also are influenced by our patients saying, no, I'm really hoping for vaginal delivery. Can we wait another hour? Can you tell me how you're thinking about this? And sometimes the heart rate is really concerning. The baby's in distress and will not do well if we don't deliver the baby soon, in which case a C-section is needed. But there are many points in labor that are should be really discussed between the woman and her provider about how are things going and how we should progress from there.
That's Dr. Maura Quinlan. She's the Illinois chair of ACOG, as we've been hearing, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She's also an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine. I want to thank Tara Haley as well, the reporter behind this Consumer Report story. We'll tweet out the link so everyone can see all that data about Illinois. Dr. Quinlan, Tara, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting the School of Art and Design Faculty Exhibition, on view through September 23rd. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Hundred and 31 years ago, Chicago workers went on strike for an 8-hour workday and to protest the deaths of several workers at the hands of police. And when officers moved in to break up a protest, someone threw a bomb. At least 4 civilians were killed, along with 7 police officers, dozens wounded as well. This became known as the Haymarket Affair, and it forever changed not just the labor movement, but the city of Chicago and world history. Paul DiRica joins us now. He's a Chicago historian, although his day job is the director of programs at Illinois Humanities. Robert Lurzel is also on the line. He's a Chicago author and freelance journalist. They're going to give us a sense back into what this was like, as well as present parallels for today. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Paul, there's so much to get into here, right? This is a huge, the Haymarket Affair, the Haymarket Incident is such a huge story, and there's so many different pieces of this. But I just wanted to start with, if you could put in context, how important is this in terms of labor history as well as the city of Chicago and Illinois history?
In order to kind of really understand its significance, you have to kind of place it back within the 19th century and kind of understand what was going on in the United States. In the decades after the Civil War, there's a whole series of depressions and recessions that makes life very precarious, particularly for working people and for immigrants. And kind of coupled with these kind of economic downturns are kind of moments of civil unrest in which the police and sometimes even the United States military are kind of called into urban centers to restore order. And oftentimes it results in violence, with the police directing their fire towards striking workers. So even though today we're going to be talking about a single incident that occurred at the intersection of Randolph and Splaines in Chicago on the 4th of May, 1886, I mean, its ramifications are great.
And when we think about that, as we think about this event, I wonder if you can describe a little bit more about the political climate at the time, as well as, you said, workers. I think we have a sense of what, you know, there are things that perhaps we take for granted today, like an 8-hour workday and things like this. What was it like in the 1880s?
A lot of the things that we take as givens today didn't exist. Healthcare provided by an employer, a pension system, child labor laws, minimum wage, even things like the weekend and the 8-hour workday. Now, Chicago, at the time of the Haymarket bombing in 1886, was like a lot of urban centers. It was rapidly changing to being a city populated primarily by immigrants. And in the late 19th century, the largest ethnic bloc in the city of Chicago were Germans. And you see that reflected in the Haymarket story. A lot of the men who spoke at the rally on the 4th of May were from Germany. But also, you see it in the sort of handbill that was used to kind of draw people to the event. So on the 3rd of May, 20,000 handbills were printed, basically calling people to a rally at Haymarket Square. And half of that handbill is in German, and the lower half is in English.
That's Paul DiRica. Robert Lurzel is with us as well. Robert did a story for WBEZ Chicago's Curious City about all of this. We'll tweet out that link because it's a really fascinating conversation with lots of people about the context of that. If you're interested in it, our handle is 21st Show. Robert, how were German immigrants viewed in Chicago, in the city, in American culture at the time?
It almost feels like it was a half German city with a lot of people of Irish and English heritage there as well. Among the Germans, you had some people who were pretty radical and in favor of things like anarchism and socialism. But you got plenty of Germans who weren't, you know, on that part of the political spectrum, just everyday people working of various political beliefs. So when you had something like Haymarket happening, you had the radical elements who were becoming sort of the scapegoats for what was going on. And this raised all kinds of criticisms of immigration. There were calls for crackdowns on immigration, where you can see some parallels with what's happening today.
Yeah. Before we get to that, Paul, can you tell us about, Robert mentioned different political groups. Anarchists are going to play a big role in this conversation, right? Because that's who eventually ends up on trial for everything. Before we get to what actually happened, who throws this bomb, what organizations, what political groups at the time were striking? Who were the sort of the players involved with all of this?
Well, there was a real spectrum involved. So the call to kind of make a push for the 8-hour workday was actually made by what became the American Federation of Labor, which today we think of as being a kind of mainstream labor organization. And they sort of set May 1st, 1886 as kind of the day to sort of make a push for the 8-hour workday all the way back in 1884. And so when the 1st of May, 1886 arrives, somewhere between 300,000 to 500,000 American workers all across the United States, men, women, and children, go on strike to push for the 8-hour workday. In Chicago, there's close to 80,000 by some estimates, some put it a little bit lower, who go on strike. One of the individuals who spoke at the rally on the 4th of May is a gentleman by the name of Albert Parsons. He was born in the United States, came from a very old family. He could trace his family back to the Mayflower, had great-grandfathers who'd fought in the Revolutionary War. During the Civil War, he fought on the side of the Confederacy, but then after the war had a political conversion and became a radical Republican, trying to fight to sort of preserve the rights of the recently emancipated slaves. But then he moves to Chicago with his wife, a former slave, Lucy Gonzalez, in the early 1870s, and he stops being a Republican and he becomes a socialist, which is left of center, but a well-established party at that time, and he runs for different city offices. But as a result of these kind of economic recessions and depressions that I described and the sort of like response by the police to some of this civil unrest, he becomes even more radicalized. So that by the time of the bombing of Haymarket Square, he's an avowed anarchist and a member of a kind of working man's party. So within the sort of space of, you know, about 20 years from the end of the Civil War to the bombing of Haymarket Square, you have one individual who's gone from being involved in a fairly mainstream major political party to being very, very far to the left and kind of calling for the complete sort of eradication of the state as we know it. And I think Parsons gives you a good sense of how kind of volatile political opinions and how varying they could be at that time. At the time, there's already other strikes that were happening for a variety of reasons. Down at the McCormick Reaper Works, you know, Cyrus McCormick invented the mechanical reaper that was based in Chicago. Well, his son had kind of locked out some of the more skilled workers and replaced them with what would be called sort of scab labor, right? Sort of like replacement labor. And so the former workers were outside the McCormick Reaper plant, basically kind of protesting that. And across the street, there were a bunch of lumberyard workers who were going on strike for the 8-hour workday. And they were being addressed by a gentleman named August Spies. August Spies was a German immigrant. He came to the United States, and he started a kind of workers' newspaper. And so he was there basically kind of encouraging the lumbermen to sort of hang together and push for the 8-hour day. Well, the end of the workday comes, the whistle at the McCormick plant sounds, and the sort of scab workers begin to leave the factory where they get into a tussle with the sort of striking workers. Police are called in, the police fire into the crowd of the McCormick workers, and it's believed at that time that about 6 workers died, although most historians now think that maybe it was at most 2. Spies witnesses all of this, and he's horrified. So he decides to go back to to his newspaper office, and since he runs a newspaper, it makes it very easy for him to print up flyers. And so after consulting with some of his associates, many of whom are really kind of radical people, right, socialists but also anarchists, he decides to basically kind of hold a protest meeting on the 4th of May in Haymarket Square. He prints out 20,000 of these handbills that get distributed all across the city. And at that time, right, this whole thing is just being thrown together. So he doesn't even know who's going to speak at it. He knows he's going to be one of the speakers, but he expects to talk last and address the crowd in German. So he shows up there on the evening of the 4th of May. There's anywhere between 2,000 to 3,000 people who have gathered. And he's horrified to learn that his friends haven't actually found any speakers. So the meeting's starting a little bit late. Nobody's there to kind of hold the crowd together. So he decides first to kind of shift the location a little bit from Randolph Street onto Des Plaines, an area that's a little bit more protected. And he basically sends his friends off to find other speakers. So Spies ends up talking to the audience actually in English for about 30 minutes. And in that time, his friends are able to find two other speakers, Albert Parsons and another gentleman by the name of Samuel Fielden, who was an English immigrant and also a former Methodist minister and preacher who was there to kind of address the crowd. So Spies talks for about 30 minutes. Parsons, who's a very gifted orator, gets up on the wagon and addresses the crowd for about 90 minutes straight, just off the cuff. And then Fielden gets on the wagon last. By now, it's almost 10:30 at night. The day is overcast. It looks like it's going to rain any minute. And the crowd has dwindled to about 300. Now, mixed into the crowd in Haymarket Square is the mayor of Chicago himself, a guy by the name of Carter Harrison. Harrison's observing everything. It seems like it's going to be a peaceful rally to kind of protest what had happened at the McCormick Reaper Works. And so he goes that block south to the police station, where there's between 170 and 180 police officers ready to march up into Haymarket Square and break up the rally, should that be required. The mayor says, you can send all the boys home to the commanding officer because it looks like the meeting is breaking up on its own. The mayor starts to head back to his house, but before he can even get there, he hears a loud bang. And what has happened? Well, the moment the mayor leaves Haymarket Square, the commanding officers, William Ward and John Bonfield, order their officers to march into Haymarket Square. They confront Fielden, who's on the wagon right then, telling him to disperse the group. Fielden says it's a peaceful rally. And at that moment, somebody steps out from the crowd. And to this day, historians don't know exactly who that individual was. And that person throws a bomb into the center of the police's ranks. One officer dies instantly. Ultimately, eight officers will die as a result of the wounds that they sustain. All of the officers had handguns on them, so the moment the bomb goes off, they also start firing as well. The whole incident lasts about 15 minutes, but as I said, about eight officers lose their lives. It's unknown how many of the strikers were wounded or who die as a result of their wounds. And then ultimately, eight men are brought to trial in connection with the bombing.
Yeah. So, Robert, I wonder if you can step in here and say, so they never figured out who threw the bomb, but who are these eight people who end up on trial?
They were basically the speakers and other associates who were connected with the anarchist movement. But the big controversy here was these men on trial were not even accused of throwing the bomb.
Some of them weren't even there, right?
Some of them had been there at various points during the evening, but some of them weren't even there or hadn't been there at all during the night. So the idea was that they were all part of this conspiracy. You know, they either had plotted to have this bomb thrown and have this attack on the police, or that their speeches had provoked this kind of action. It's kind of the prosecution is sort of making the equivalent argument of, you know, this was not protected speech of what they're doing because they were provoking people into acts of subversion and violence, but they were being charged with murder, so it was a very controversial, this idea of prosecuting them for this.
What does happen with these men, Paul? Would you say that the trial, from a historical context, the trial and the aftermath almost end up overshadowing what actually happened?
I would say so, but we also have to keep in mind what actually happened. So here we are about 20-some years removed from the Civil War and all of the sort of violence and devastation that attended that. But what happened on that night in Chicago was unprecedented because you had a single person could hold a single small device in his hand, throw it into the crowd, and kind of wreak this kind of havoc. And so people were scared, right? And when they got scared, they closed ranks and they went after anybody that they could attach blame to. And that's how those eight men ended up on trial. And public opinion was very much against them in the beginning. But as the trial went on and concluded, and all but one of the eight were sentenced to die, one of them, who had very little to do with the incident, was sent off to prison, but to a life term, I want to add. But in the aftermath, public opinion begins to shift slightly, so that by the time that the men have exhausted their appeal and the execution date is set for the 11th of November, 1887, there are many people who realize that maybe there's been a rush to judgment and that maybe there were some problems with the trial. What ends up happening is some of the men are encouraged to write to the then governor of Illinois asking for clemency. And two of them do, and they receive life sentences in prison. Another decides that he doesn't want the state to take his life. So on the eve of the execution, he commits suicide in his cell. He was the youngest person put on trial. So he was 24 when he went on trial and 25 when he took his own life. And then the following day, the four other men are put to death. And so after the execution, the bodies are returned to the families. And there's a huge funeral in what is today sort of Wicker Park neighborhood of Chicago that thousands attend before the bodies of the five dead men are taken to a cemetery outside Chicago. And that becomes a kind of rallying point for labor, right? And the memory of these men become a kind of rallying point for labor. And that's why starting in 1889, but really, you know, crystallizing in 1904, that's how the 1st of May becomes a kind of like labor holiday the world round.
This is fascinating. I'm speaking with Paul DiRica, a Chicago historian, and Robert Lorzel, a Chicago journalist, about the Haymarket affair. Guys, we just have a couple minutes left, and I have to talk about today, right? Because I feel like you can't have this conversation without looking at it in present-day context. And I wonder, Paul, how you think what the Haymarket affair tells us about what sort of what the parallels are today, what the lasting impacts of it are, and the way that we view labor, the way that we view... Why don't you do labor, and then, Robert, you can talk about sort of the way that we view immigrants as well. Paul?
To me, the biggest lesson about Haymarket is this idea that, like, nothing is a given, right? Today, a lot of us work more than 40 hours a week. But the idea that an eight-hour day is just a kind of given thing and that we've accepted that, that's not true. People had to really sort of, you know, struggle and persist in order to achieve even that. And that means that it can be taken away. And then, you know, the last several years, right, we've seen a really sort of concentrated attack on organized labor in particular. I would just say kind of working people in general. And a lot of these things that we've kind of regarded as given have been sort of taken away or eroded. That said, the Haymarket story can also serve as an inspiration because these people were able to achieve a lot of things, right? And eventually we did get an eight-hour work day and we did get child labor laws and we did get pension plans and all the other things that I talked about a little bit earlier in this segment.
Yeah, Robert, what do you think in terms of, especially about immigrants? That's something I know you wanted to weigh in on.
It's striking how in the days right after Haymarket, people, including some congressmen from Chicago, raised concerns about radical immigrants coming to the country. And they began calling for a way of testing anyone who enters the country to see if they support the Constitution, and the American way of life, and our government. And eventually, it didn't happen right away after Haymarket. It took a couple of decades leading up to the assassination of President McKinley. So finally, in I think it was 1903, a law was passed to keep anarchists out of the country. And I see parallels with what the Trump administration is talking about doing today with trying to have some sort of way of blocking people who are radical Islamists from entering the U.S. But it all comes down to this challenging, difficult question of how would you even test someone to really see what's in their heart and in their mind to see if they, you know, support the American way of life. How do you define that? So back in the 1800s, after Haymarket, there was efforts at it, but, you know, they never really came up with a system of doing that.
The sort of central questions around the story, whether it's the meaning of the bombing or the reaction to immigrant communities, or whether or not people can be held accountable not for what they do per se, but what they say in certain incidents. These are all issues that are very resonant in the contemporary moment.
Yeah. So it's sort of 131 years ago, and we're still having some of these same conversations. I want to thank Paul DiRica, public historian, director of programs at Illinois Humanities, Chicago-based writer, journalist Robert Lorzel, has a great story he did about this for WBEZ. We'll tweet that link out if anyone wants to go further into this history. Paul, Robert, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A filly named Rachel Alexandra had an unlikely path to 2009 Horse of the Year. Despite being labeled unsuitable as a champion racehorse, she overcame the odds, went on to break numerous records, and earned that title of Horse of the Year, and show the world what it really means to run like a girl. The horse is at the center of a new nonfiction book for middle grade readers. It's called Alexandra the Great, the story of the record-breaking filly who ruled the racetrack. And I'm joined in studio now by its Urbana-based author, Deb Aronson. Deb, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you, Nyla. It's great to be here.
So you write in this book, when this little horse, this foal was born, you never would have thought a few years later that she would capture the hearts and minds of lots of people, but especially lots of little girls and women across the country with her girl power. Is that what attracted you to this story?
Yes, absolutely. I am not a horse race fan generally, but I remember when Rachel was in the news and she had a very distinctive blaze, which makes her stand out in a crowd. And so I was really rooting for her. And that was exactly what appealed to me.
So you used the term blaze. I learned a lot of horse terms in this book. And fortunately, it's great because it's a middle grade reading book. They're sort of like the bold words of blaze. That's like a facial marking a horse has on its, I guess, like, well, really on its face, right? All the way from
yes.
its ears all the way down to its mouth, its nose.
Yes. It's basically on what I think of as her forehead. And then their stockings, which are what are down on the feet.
And those how did you learn? Yeah. How did you learn all of these different horse terms? Because you spent a lot of time with the people who, lots of people will know the name Calvin Burrell, the very famous jockey who rode Rachel. I think even people who are not horse people or follow the Derby or other big races will know his name because he's so famous. You spoke with him and her owners, lots of people.
Yes, I have to give a shout out to her original trainer, Hal Wiggins, who sat with me in his living room for 2 full days, basically telling me about how thoroughbreds are trained and that kind of thing. And he was really the best resource. But like any writer, I did a lot of other research too.
And what kind of research goes into writing a book, especially if you're writing this? Why did you pick, by the way, middle grade readers as the target for this?
I picked middle grade because in my own reading life, that was the age where books just really came to life for me. I always was an avid reader, but there was something about middle grade that those books that I read, particularly I remember a biography about Marie Curie, that just made me feel like I was part of that world and really, really resonated with me. So I like the idea of writing for other kids that might have that same experience.
And so what age would you say this is particularly designed for?
Well, it's kind of a vague thing, and it depends, of course, on people's reading levels, but I would say something like 10 to 14. I also like to think that middle grade is a level of reading that actually most adults will also enjoy. So it's not a hard and fast.
So this is sort of like before YA or...
Before YA okay. and after picture book.
And so when you talk to lots of people to sort of understand the horse terminology, what other kind of research did you do into her story of this horse?
So, of course, I went online. I watched all of her races, which are all on video available. I read tons and tons of newspaper articles. And then really for me, interviewing the people that knew her and worked with her was the most important. In my regular day job, I write profiles anyway for other kinds of publications. And I love meeting people. I love hearing their stories. I feel like that's the kind of thing that brings a story like this to life. And so once Hal Wiggins met me and helped me, he also introduced me to all the other people that were so central to Rachel's life.
And so that's what this is. This is a story of this particular personality, which is his horse. And you have a line in the book that I really love, which is you say that horses have personalities too. What did you learn about Rachel's personality?
What I learned about Rachel is she is really a diva. She's a diva and she's an athlete. So she was not trying to be a crowd pleaser. But if people cheered, she just kind of was like, yes, I know. I'm a queen. Thank you very much. That is as my due. And it's a fine line to not anthropomorphize. But on the other hand, from her body language, you can understand that she really knows that she's top notch. And she's not going to apologize for it. And on the other hand, if you go to visit her at Stone Street Farm where she's retired, she knows that people are coming to take her photograph, and she will pose. That happened when I visited her.
So she posed for you.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about some of Rachel's accomplishments, Rachel Alexander's accomplishments, before we get to sort of the story of how she got. Can you talk about some of the records that she broke, especially as a filly, as a female horse? Because horse racing is an interesting sport where male and female animals can compete against each other, but it's not that common.
That's right, particularly in American thoroughbred racing. The first race that really put her on the map for sort of the general newspaper reader was the Kentucky Oaks, which is the race for fillies, only fillies, the day before
the Derby.
Kentucky Derby, mm-hmm. which everybody knows about. And Rachel destroyed the field of fillies. They were all the same age. They were all fillies. And she beat them by 20 lengths. They were practically not in the same field of view for the camera. So then the world set up and took notice. It was shortly after that that she got sold to a different owner because he really did want to see her compete against the boys. There's a long story there about the pros and cons. But after that, her biggest accomplishments were the next race, which was just 2 weeks later, the Preakness, which is the second race in the Triple Crown. And she not only raced against 12 horses that were all male, but she started from the outside gate, the 13th gate. Nobody had ever won the race from
the 13th gate. No horse had ever won that, right.
So that was a big thing. And I guess, and no filly had won that race in 85 years. So that's a pretty big deal.
And what I love about this is you also have the relationship with her to Calvin Burrell, because was he the first jockey to win the Triple Crown on three different horses? Was that, or the? Or,
no, he did not that year win the, no.
He had won, because what he had raced.
He had raced Mind That Bird. So the day after the Kentucky Oaks, he raced Mind That Bird, which had a 50-1 odds to win the Derby. And he came an amazing come from behind. And he did
he
win
won
that.
The Derby. And so, then he won the Preakness racing Rachel
yes,
Alexandra.
Yes. But I
oh, then he didn't
he
win.
Didn't
oh,
win
he didn't
Belmont.
Win. Oh, he didn't win Belmont. Okay.
No.
Sorry. So that's not the Triple Crown there.
No,
right.
But I think what's really striking about that is that he did have a chance by winning on Mind That Bird. He could have stayed on Mind That Bird for the Preakness and gone for the Triple Crown. And to me, that was very, very striking that he chose to get off that horse in order to ride Rachel because he thought she was absolutely the most amazing horse he'd ever ridden.
And they really have this. He loved her. And I think my favorite part of this book is how even after she retires, she never forgets him. And when he comes back to visit her, which he still does, she recognizes him right away.
Yes. I think there aren't that many people that had that kind of relationship with her. And Calvin, as people who know him know, wears his heart on his sleeve. So he's just a big barrel of emotion. But he still was over the top in his affection for Rachel. I mean, he loves racing, obviously, but there's something about Rachel Alexander that just captured his heart. He really loved her, loved her, loved her.
And what was it about this horse that captured everyone else's heart, too? Because you describe when she starts running races, how many people start wearing pink hats, how many little girls start. There's sort of all of these T-shirts that say run like a girl. And this becomes sort of a whole thing also of people really embracing her.
Yes. I don't know completely what appealed to other people. I think a big, big part of it was this storyline of a girl racing boys and beating them. There just are not that many storylines like that. And the other thing that appealed to me about Rachel Alexander's story is the few other times where fillies have challenged male horses. In many times, they've tragically broken down and they've had to be euthanized at the track. And Rachel was really strong and her legs never gave her trouble. That's, you know, the weak point on a racehorse. And I just love that she prevailed.
My guest is Deb Aronson. She's an Urbana-based author. She's the author of a new nonfiction book that's out for middle grade readers. It's called Alexander the Great, The Story of the Record-Breaking Filly Who Ruled the Racetrack. One of the things that's really interesting about this is you talk about the gender, just sort of little the history of the gender discrimination in horse racing, and how her story fits into that, and how even when they tried to enter her into the Preakness, a lot of the male horse owners were really upset, and they were trying to enter other horses in because they didn't want her to compete because she was a last minute entry.
It's a complicated story in the sense that Some fillies do have the physical attributes to race against male horses, but there's also this complicating factor of how expensive horse racing is if you are a trainer and an owner. And so there's a kind of, you don't want to risk hurting your horse, putting her maybe in a situation that is going to end up with her injured. I will mention two things that I found very interesting. In quarter horse racing, they're always mixed fields. Now, it's a much shorter, it's a quarter mile race every time, so that's different. Plus, they're not thoroughbreds, so they're not as delicate. But in Europe, apparently, many races have both males and females in them. It's only in the United States where there are so many horses for fillies only that many owners think it just makes more sense financially to keep in that category.
And I think it's interesting that her first owner refused to let her compete against male horses. Do you think how much of that was just sort of a money thing? Because it's, if you have a good filly, you can race her in other races and just make a lot more money that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a simple storyline to say, oh, that owner, you know, was so mean. He didn't want Rachel to see her full potential. But the fact is, and one of the
things, it's a business decision.
It's a business decision.
Right.
Also, Dolph Morrison, who died last fall, was her original breeder and owner, and he was a small-time guy. He had a handful of horses. He loved to do it, but it was a hobby. He didn't have millions of dollars at his disposal. Now, Jess Jackson, who bought Rachel after that, has millions of dollars.
Well, he paid $10 million for her, which is kind of crazy to think he paid $10 million for this horse.
It was unheard of, an unheard of number for a filly. People pay that much sometimes for male horses, but never for a filly, and not to race her.
And to remind Jackson, this is Kendall Jackson, the winery owner. That's where his money came from also. This is sort of another business he has, which is horse racing.
That's right. That's right.
And he was the one who just said, you know what, let's just try it and see what happens.
Yes, that's right. So it's easy to think, oh, you know, big, bad millionaire.
I spent $10 million on this horse,
right,
but let's
just
see.
But on the other hand, it's kind of cool to think about what kind of personality is willing to get a filly at that cost and still just run her, you know, just see what she could do. Now, granted, he also owned Curlin, who was the horse of the year the previous year, 2008, and he did breed them. So, you know, there was an added motivation, but he was ready to let her run as long as she enjoyed running.
Deb, what did you learn most about the world of horse racing that you wanted to convey in this book?
Well, I want to just say first that the main story that I wanted to tell was a girl power story, flat out. Some of the things that I learned along the way about the world don't actually really fit in a middle grade book. There are things about, like, some of those financial considerations, you know, some of the egos that are involved, all these kinds of interesting things about that world that don't fit in a middle grade
book. Not really appropriate for that age group, too.
No.
Sure.
Yeah.
So does it make you want to write another book about her?
Not really. I will say that, again, the people I met were lovely. But that was a very small corner of the racing world, and it's pretty insular. I think it would be pretty hard to write that other story.
So I was thinking about this book. I was thinking that one of my nieces would love this. She's 11. I think it's just the perfect book for her. But you made a really interesting comment to me. This is a girl power book that you want boys to read also.
Yes. I know that, and it was in the back of my mind from the very beginning that, you know, that many girls go through a horse crazy stage. And I definitely wrote this story with them in mind. But I feel like I want everybody to read this book. I feel like it's a great story of an underdog. It's a story about a little horse who was abandoned by her mom, who was knock-kneed and scruffy, and she turned into this amazing athlete. And I think that's a great story for boys, too. I made the point recently to somebody else that if the men and the boys in our life can't cheer for the females in their life, then we're not in good shape. So yes, I would encourage anyone with a nephew or a niece or a grandchild of any gender to give them this book.
And if for you, it's a story of girl power, but it also sounds like it's a story of perseverance.
Yes, it is. It's definitely a story of perseverance. And it's a story, I don't know, of just flat out athleticism. I mean, she is a big horse with a glossy coat and big muscles. There's another famous filly, Ruffian, who was very, very, very fast, but she had these skinny little stick legs, and she didn't make it. She broke down on the track.
Mm. This is the story of Rachel Alexandra, also known as Alexandra the Great. That's the title of this book. It's called Alexandra the Great, the story of the record-breaking filly who ruled the racetrack. It's a new book out by the Urbana-based writer Deb Aronson. Deb, thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla. I enjoyed it.
That does it for us today. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.